going to get out there a little bit today, right? That can happen in this business. Out there, I'm talking about space. Because we've been chatting a little bit about it here, too. We're going to learn more. This Artemis space program, American space exploration, is back up for grabs, as they might say on Survivor. And it is kind of a Survivor mission as well. Going to the moon, going to Mars, going to who knows where after that. We're going to be talking about that today with Aiden Augustinelli, who is a presenter with the University of Montana Planetarium and Stargazing Room. And then, since we're speaking about University of Montana, how's that presidential search going? Dave Koontz will join us a bit later on today. Get you updated, keep you connected here today on Voices of Montana. And when we're talking about space, right? Because, I don't know, there's no boundaries in space, so to speak. Well, I mean, getting there's a lot of physical boundaries to get there. But what is this Artemis 2 mission? What's the Artemis mission overall? We're going to get right into that here today. As I mentioned, Dave Koontz a bit later on, Director of Strategic Communications, University of Montana. Their search for the 20th president of that great institution is underway. So we'll find out about that process too. But welcoming a presenter with the Planetarium and Stargazing Room at the University of Montana, it's Aiden Augustinelli. Aiden, how you doing, sir?
Good morning, Tom. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Artemis 2. We're just so curious about a lot of things here. And I think we've got up to speed a little bit on some things, about what this mission was about, because it was completed over the weekend, actually, on Friday. Pretty exciting. What's your take? What do we need to know right now? And then, as a stargazer yourself, so to speak, what does this mean for you?
Well, this is really an exciting step towards some of our long-term space exploration goals. So I'm personally thrilled at the success of the Artemis 2 missions. We saw the Artemis 1 mission go around the moon a couple of years back, and the purpose of that mission was really to test the capabilities of the SLS spacecraft and the Orion systems. And so that was an unmanned flight. So it's really exciting that with this mission, we saw humans go back into space for the first time since the Apollo missions took them out of low Earth orbit. So these are astronauts that are making it beyond the reaches of Earth's gravitational pull out into the vicinity of the moon. So this is really fantastic for someone in my position, because I know that there are many generations of astronomers, astrophysicists that did not see people make it out this far. This mission was very successful, and so I'm really looking forward to the future missions and to the science goals that those missions will be able to complete.
Did we have a lot of new information come off of this? I mean, I know that's, you always have something new, but, in terms of what the mission goals were and what was the mission, what the mission accomplished, is there just more stuff now to pour through, Aiden?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of a twofold answer to that question. And the first is that the Artemis 2 mission was really designed to test the life support systems aboard these lunar exploration vehicles. And so with that, they were testing, is the oxygen flowing correctly? Is there a program to be deployed in the case of fire? Is the waste disposal system working correctly? And so we learned a lot just from testing these systems in action. And that was kind of the overarching goal of this mission. We wanted to put people in the capsule, get it up into space, and just see how it did. It was also the first time that this capsule was being flown by human beings. So on that first Artemis 1 mission, everything was from afar or pre-programmed. And now we can see that the system is actually performing really well under crew operation. So these pilots are actually taking the controls and maneuvering around the moon. So that was very exciting.
Yeah.
And secondarily, the crew saw the far side of the moon in sunlight for the first time. So that's something that humans have never seen before, and it allowed them to really categorize some of the lunar features that we had never seen clearly before. One of the most exciting findings, in my opinion, is that there's a lot of color on the moon. So these astronauts noticed, yellows and browns and greens and things that we normally wouldn't associate with the moon's surface. So through the characterization of that other side of the moon, we've learned a ton about the lunar landscape and what kinds of things might be going on over there.
Did I read somewhere that they also got a look at the poles?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that flight path around the back of the moon took them farther out than ever before. So you can imagine that as they came around the far side of the moon, they had a little bit of a wider field of view of the moon at large. So they were able to see, get a wider view of kind of the poles from the side. And that's really exciting because we know that there are interesting features at the lunar poles.
Aidan Agustinelli is with us. He's a presenter, University of Montana Planetarium and Stargazing Room. So why are we out there?
Why are we out there? This might be something that is a little bit different person to person. I imagine if you ask every person in NASA's mission control room, they may have a slightly different answer.
Yeah.
In my opinion, space exploration is really a kind of key facet of an American identity. This is really rooted in our history. The Apollo missions that put men on the moon for the first time were a huge bolster to our kind of foothold as a leading nation in the world. And so there's a kind of a political aspect to the Artemis missions where we are establishing ourselves as a country with space programs that are still capable of really pushing the boundaries of science. We can do new things. We can do things better. We can do things faster. We can do things cheaper and more efficiently. And so I think one answer is that these missions politically, show the rest of the world what we can do. But then the flip side of that coin is there's no reason to do it unless we're taking something away from it. So the science here is really exciting because the moon is kind of a first baseline to further solar system exploration. So we've been to the moon before. We're making sure we can still do that in a safe way and in a modern way. Because now we have new equipment, we know that we can be safer this time. And with the lunar missions, the goal eventually is to establish a base on the moon. So think ISS for this, where we have a continuously occupied kind of space location. That's what we're aiming for there on the moon. And that would allow us to do a lot more long-term lunar science. And it would also allow us to start to develop systems for further solar system exploration, specifically kind of with our sights set on Mars long-term.
And there are a lot of ancillary things, I think, that come from, and at least we've learned that. I mean, it's been since, when was Apollo 17? I have it right here. 1972, wasn't it? The last time we were there? Yeah. And so I know that NASA and other scientists around the world have benefited by, like you say, pushing the boundary of science to get back out there. But what's the difference between a 1972 moon mission and this 2026 or next, or maybe it's 2027 moon mission?
That's a great question. And that's kind of a sentiment that I've heard, asked and echoed many times. Mm-hmm. And I think this is also a question that has kind of a multifaceted answer. The first is that we're using different rocket systems this time. The actual lunar module, like what the astronauts are flying and living in, looks a lot different than it did in the 70s. And so the reason that that's important, why we wouldn't just use the same one, is because we do have our sights set eventually on further solar system exploration. And the goal would be to use similar systems. And so, we've been to the moon before, but we know that we won't be using that same technology. And so as a scientist, if your long-term goal is go to Mars, your natural first step is, can we test this technology in a place where we have more capability to communicate with our astronauts? Can we do this in a lower stakes way to ensure that these systems are operating absolutely perfectly before we head out farther distances to a location like Mars? I also think that it's really important to consider kind of symbolically what the 2026 version of this moon mission represents. We had a lot of folks on board this mission that would not have been afforded the opportunity to go to space previously at the time of the Apollo mission. So we had the first woman to leave low Earth orbit and head out to the moon, the first person of color to do so, and the first Canadian. And so those things are really exciting to me too, because we have really fantastic scientists from all kinds of backgrounds across North America and really the world. But it's important to award those astronauts the opportunity to fly to space too, because if those folks are the best for the job, we want to make sure that they're the ones that are on board.
Yeah, and they're...
And so in 26...
Go ahead, yeah.
Thanks. In 26, we really now have the capability to give those best of the best the opportunity to be out there and doing the science.
And that's one question I had here too, because as you noted, the Canadian Space Agency, Jeremy Hansen from Canada there as well. This international aspect of it, does it get a little bit tricky at times? Or is it basically more of a funding boost that's needed? Because I don't think it's cheap to fly just to the moon.
You know, it's kind of both. It does get tricky, but it's also something that provides a lot of advantages. And this is true across space exploration and space science in general. Astronomy and astrophysics is a science that's very internationally collaborative. So it's really common for scientists to be working with Canadians, to be working with Germans and Europeans in general. And so the extension of kind of our background astrophysics research as being an international web to, you know, bringing that internationality to the astronauts we send up, that feels like a very natural extension, at least to me as someone that's been working in that kind of environment. And, you know, it brings challenges of who has jurisdiction over the mission control room, who gets to sit there, how does each individual international program select their astronauts? If it's a NASA mission, does NASA have final say over Canadian astronauts, or does the Canadian Space Agency get to put up, you know, their pick for their mission? So although I'm not sure exactly how that conversation went down between the two agencies, I'm sure it was a conversation, as all things are around a mission like this. You always talk about every little detail down to, you know, what kind of bolt you're using on the door.
How far is the moon? 238,900 miles. If you're going to drive that, it would take you 6 months, non-stop highway speed. But, you know, if you got a rocket, it's not that long, right? So fly them if you got them. Aiden Augustinelli is with us here. He is a presenter at the University of Montana's Planetarium and Stargazing Room. They have an actual presentation going on here on the 17th. We'll talk about that. That's open to the public. Aiden, I appreciate you coming on here. Let's go back. Let's go beyond the moon now, because the Artemis 3 mission is going to put some astronauts on the moon. But the long-term plan for this is to establish a sustainable presence on the moon. Put those pieces together for us. How does man get to Mars and back again?
Absolutely. So we saw with the Artemis 1 mission, kind of our first step here, which was a test flight of the rocket. And then, of course, Artemis 2 just sent people around the back of the moon for the first time since the 70s. So those were two missions with a big step up from number one to number two. The step up from number two to number three is actually not quite so extreme. The third mission, Artemis 3, has actually changed from what it was originally planned to be, because NASA added a demonstration mission. This is an additional mission that they kind of injected into the middle of their plan. So Artemis 3 is now actually a mission that is going to take place just in low Earth orbit. This will be mid-27. And the goal of this mission is to test landers from private companies. I believe it's SpaceX and Blue Origin. And so the goal of testing these private company landers is going to be to figure out which lander is going to work the best for when they do eventually send astronauts to land on the moon, which will be Artemis 4 now. That number has changed.
Gotcha.
So once the landers are tested and they decide which lander they want to use, they're ready to go for Artemis 4. And this will aim to land in early 28. So early 28 is when you can keep your eyes peeled for another moon landing. So during this landing, they'll transfer from the main rocket from Orion, where they were for the Artemis 2 missions, over to that lunar lander that they'll pick out in the Artemis 3 mission. And that lander will take them down to the surface. And then once they're there, they'll carry out some science missions. They will do, you know, some engagement with folks back at home on Earth, just like the original Apollo missions. And then they'll come back up and head home. And from that point forward, NASA is hoping to launch missions consistently, I think yearly is their goal, starting with Artemis 5 later in 2028. And then that mission will be when they start establishing that moon base that we were discussing earlier.
You're probably getting this question too, but what does a sustainable human presence on the moon look like? And I know people are going, well, they want to go up there and mine for silver or whatever it is. I don't find that very realistic because, you know, you don't have a processing center on the moon and you can't throw it off the moon back to Earth, so to speak. I know it's ridiculous. But comment on that. You know, what does a sustainable human presence look like on the moon?
Yeah, this is kind of the open question. What does a sustainable human presence look like on the moon? There are different people with very different ideas about what this presence should look like. I imagine that ultimately the most important factor for this sustained presence is going to be our actual science goals. So the purpose of the moon base is not only to expand our capabilities in space beyond the surface of the Earth, but also to practice some of our skills that are going to be applicable in later space exploration, you know, as we head out to Mars. Those missions are much further into the future, not as thoroughly planned or laid out yet. But I think a human presence on the moon will look like, you know, a lot of agriculture, really, because we're interested in the sustainability or possibility of growing food on the surface of other bodies in our solar system. And so I imagine that the scientists that are there, the astronauts that are there, will be really focused on cultivating some of those opportunities to give humans kind of some autonomy to self-sustain off of the surface of the Earth.
Hmm.
I also think that there will be lots of science goals just in terms of geology, in terms of moon history, moon mapping, exploration. But this moon base is scheduled to be, or is slated to be built near the south pole of the moon, which is interesting because we think there's potential water ice there.
Yeah.
And so there's also a lot of questions about how that water is locked up on the surface of the moon, how accessible it is, and how it can be used for our astronauts. So I imagine that one of the other big missions of the moon base will be figuring out, you know, where can we get our water and is it good to drink? What can we do with it? That kind of thing.
Yeah. What kind of challenges do you think they're going to encounter? I mean, what are some of the huge hills that they have to get over so they can get back safely?
You know, I think that the moment where astronauts step from the Orion capsule to the lander has got to be incredibly nerve-wracking. And these are folks that are trained just like military members. Astronauts are effectively really like very specially trained soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are not people that bulk easily at a challenge, but I'm sure that even with their training, that moment is going to be a moment where they have to take a deep breath because the lander is something that you can't practice completely here on Earth. They certainly simulate it. They will practice flying that lander down to the surface of the moon in like a flight simulation over and over and over again. But you never know, you know, if you get hit by a stray little pebble in space, that's rare because space is mostly empty, but it could happen. If you enter at an angle that's a little bit different than what you were expecting, let's say you have a little rocket booster that burns out and then all of a sudden you're spinning. I think really there's a lot of things that could be challenging. And our hope is that our astronauts are trained enough to think on the fly and overcome whatever challenges they inevitably will face.
Yeah. And that's part of the whole learning process there as well. And so it is a dangerous job. You know, we've seen movies, you know, I'm not going back to Star Trek days, but like The Martian, if you ever saw the movie Apollo 13, those are just fabulous movies. They're so, you know, super science based nowadays too. And, we understand that we possibly can have a place there, in space. But I know it's going to take a little while. Aiden Agustinelli is with us here, presenter, University of Montana Planetarium and Stargazing Room. I got a couple of minutes here. I got 3 minutes, actually. And I want to, you know, what is the planetarium? What's the Stargazing Room? And you got a little presentation upcoming here as well. Let's brag about what you're doing.
Absolutely. So our planetarium, I think, is really a hidden gem on the University of Montana campus. When we think stargazing, we often think of big telescopes outside actually visually scanning the night sky. And that's fantastic. We have that in Missoula, too. That's the Blue Mountain Observatory. But a planetarium is actually an inside dome where our whatever we're looking at is projected up on the ceiling in a really immersive and fantastic way. And you may have seen, you know, folks in Montana may be familiar with the Museum of the Rockies. They've got a planetarium there. Those planetariums and many planetariums around the country are pre-recorded shows. So these are shows that fantastic scientists and presenters develop, but then they, you know, press play on the show and you watch kind of a movie on the dome. Well, the UM Planetarium is not that way, and we're very proud of that. All of our shows are live and interactive. So you have a student training in astrophysics there with you, giving a live lecture, asking you questions, there to answer your questions. And we have shows that are available to the public throughout the course of the spring semester. So those shows are continuing through the rest of the spring. We've got a show on existential astrophysics. I'm presenting one on sunsets across the solar system. We've got one on the oldest light in the universe. But many of our presenters will also be at the UM Conference of Undergraduate Research on Friday, this upcoming Friday the 17th. And that's where you can come if you'd like to see more real research and physics presented in a real way. That's kind of the back end of what eventually becomes shows for the public in the planetarium.
I got a minute left. What is this conference about again?
This is a conference for university students to present research they've done during their time as an undergraduate. So there will be astrophysicists there, but that's not the only science that you can see. It's completely open to the public in the university center. You can see biologists, you can see social scientists, you can see even creative projects. I know that, you know, majors in dance and theater can also present their work there. So this is really a celebration of all of the great science and creative scholarship that's occurring on the University of Montana campus.
Yeah.
It's going to be a really fun time.
Yeah. And, you know, and the new ideas and the new ways of looking things that emerged from this. Aiden Agustinelli again with us here, presenter, University of Montana Planetarium and Stargazing Room. You can go to the university website and search for that, Planetation and Stargazing Room. They got a good Facebook page as well. Aiden, I appreciate the information. I appreciate what you guys are doing. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
From exploring the far side of the moon to exploring the future leadership at one of Montana's flagship universities. Welcome back here again from Montana for Montana. Good old Voices of Montana. We're 2 decades strong and working on 3. Hello to our friends in Glasgow. They catch us a bit later on in the day on KLTZ at 1240 a.m. Appreciate you up there listening along as well. We're going to go back to the University of Montana. As I mentioned, there is a search ongoing here. And, you know, I'm curious about what are the criteria and deadlines and you know, all that goes into selecting. I mean, what are the qualifications? What do you want to see in the next University of Montana president? The 20th, Dave Kuntz joins us, who's a friend of ours, a friend of the program, and a longtime colleague as well. He's the director of strategic communications at the University of Montana. I got to give you props, Dave. I hit Dave up every now and again to say, hey, Dave, can you find me somebody? Aiden did a great job talking about the Artemis mission and the planetarium. How are things going, sir?
Thanks, Tom. Really glad to join you. Things are great here. You know, it's been a fun semester with lots of surprises and twists and turns along the way, but we're getting some certainty here, and the University of Montana is in great shape. We're growing and excited for this last month as we push forward towards commencement season over here.
Yeah, I mean, and this is why I think that you're that Clayton Christian, who's Board of Regents, Commissioner of Higher Education, pushed for this expedited national search, because you know, there are a lot of things going on. And as you said, I had to smile big when you said, well, there's been some surprises here. I'm not sure anybody saw this coming. We liked Seth Bodner as the president, but he's moved on there as well. So what are the qualifications? I mean, what do you look for in when it comes to selecting the next, not just a university president, but University of Montana president?
You know, the president job here at the University of Montana, just like any other large state-funded flagship university, is a big job. Not only do you have all of the academic responsibilities that your listeners are aware of, but we really run a miniature city over here. You know, we have 11,000 students, which include 4,000 students who sleep here overnight in our residence halls. We serve over 10,000 meals a day out of our dining halls. We have our own basically semi-pro professional entertainment industry through Grizzly Athletics and the concerts we host. We have our own transportation division. So it's really like running a small business over here on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, when we had the unexpected turnover that we had here in January, Commissioner Christian showed great leadership along with the Board of Regents, and they made a decision to move as quickly as possible to fill this opening so we didn't have a long gap in leadership. And we had tremendous folks here in our senior leadership team who stepped up and really filled that gap the past few months. But we're happy to say we think we have our guy, and the board voted this morning to move a contract forward for Dr. Jeremiah Shin, who is currently the president at Boise State University. And we anticipate he'll sign that contract here later today, and we'll have the 20th president of the University of Montana in place.
Well, congratulations. I should have a sound effect board here, and bells ought to be going off and rings and applause for something like that. So tell us about the next University of Montana president, Dr. Jeremiah Shin.
Yeah, Dr. Shin was on campus last week, so we all really got to spend some time with him and get to know him. And we think he's going to be a really great fit. You know, he grew up in a rural community down in Arkansas, was the first member of his family to go to college at Arkansas Tech, and from there really started to excel in the classroom. And that took him to the University of Michigan and the University of Eastern Michigan, where he got his PhD. And then for the past 20 years, he's been a senior leader at Boise State with a small little jump he did over to LSU, where he was the vice president at Louisiana State University. And then for about the past year, he served in an interim capacity as the president at Boise State. But he shares a lot of the same values we have here at the University of Montana, where we value access. We think every student should be able to attend our university and do so with as little cost as possible. He's got a great eye towards career readiness and things that we've done really well here at the university in recent years to ensure that regardless of what our students are studying, they are ready to succeed. And we think he's going to be a really good, strong partner for the state to be able to help identify new areas of study, places where industry really needs the university to step up in terms of workforce demand. So we think we have a person who really shares what the University of Montana values, and we're excited to get him on board here in the coming months and really hit the ground running this summer with him.
Yeah, well, of course, you've offered, and he has not officially accepted yet, or I suppose, so that's part of the story right now, I guess, but very excited for you. Faculty, students, alumni, administration, community leaders, Board of Regents, all those organizations, groups, individuals played a part in this. Talk about that process, because you noted some things. University of Montana, access for everybody, career readiness, partner for the state. Those were some of the criteria. Not all those groups bring the same criteria. So talk about organizing all those groups to come down with a single choice.
You know, it can be quite the gauntlet. And during the interview process, that's what really started to separate Dr. Shin, is he met with some of these groups, and as Commissioner Christian put together a working group that had the diverse reflection of our campus on it, he was able to, you know, address concerns from faculty about the need for academic rigor and some of the accreditation things that we have come around the corner that we need to do a great job at. He did a great job, too, with our staff, the support staff that run the university and are really the backbone of the university to make sure that, you know, offices like financial aid and our ability to retain students are top-notch. And then where he also really excelled is with the students. Like you say, we have a very active student leadership body here at the university, and he spent a lot of time with them. He really cut his teeth as he climbed the ladder in that student service realm of universities. So understanding, you know, what students need to succeed in the classroom, what we need to do to keep them on track to graduation, what we need to be doing to increase their time to graduation to limit that cost of school for them. So he did a great job, and it's why he was the unanimous selection across the working group. That working group had folks from faculty, from staff, students on it. as well as some former regents. And so he really did a good job of showing that he had that broad understanding of a university and can really step in here on day one and make a difference. And we're really excited to start working alongside of him.
How do people do that? How does the community, how does the business community, all those different entities, as you mentioned, going to be a good partner for the state? That, I mean, there's no end, I think, to organizations that have connection to education.
That's right. And one of the things that really attracted us to Dr. Shin was he did come from a peer institution in Boise State, a city that's, you know, the state next door to us has similar demographics, similar growth challenges. And so he has great experience in partnering with industry. You know, here at UM, we've really reemphasized in recent years our business and industry partnerships. We have much more short-term credentialing education opportunities than we did prior to 2020, which provides students the ability to get in and out of the classroom in as little as 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 18 weeks, usually in partnership with an employer. So we can provide that training and make sure they're job ready. We're also doing making tremendous progress in healthcare and health access. We're launching Montana's first physician's assistant school in the fall, and his experience with understanding rural health and rural health systems was really important. But you know, we know here at UM we can't just exist on an island here by ourselves, that we really need to be embedded in the state and be able to produce graduates with the skill sets that business and industry needs, and especially business and industry here in Montana. And so being able to find a leader who comes from a similar region, who understands some of the same growth challenges we're facing, we think that he will be able to hit that ground running. And we expect as soon as this summer, as he gets his feet on the ground, that he'll be getting out and about across the state to really get that good understanding of production agriculture, rural health, our K-12 systems, so he can make sure that we're making strong decisions here at UM that can help feed into the state's economy.
Dave Kuhn's with us, a longtime acquaintance, Director of Strategic Communications at the University of Montana. Can he toss a pizza?
He can. He will. You know, we have a brand new dining hall, and so he'll get run through the ringer, and he'll learn how to toss a pizza and flip a burger and make a grizz claw too.
That's great. That's part of the fun, you know. I mean, and Seth was really good at that, being genuine with the students, understanding, I think, their plight and their journey and the kind of future that you guys are preparing them for. What are the challenges? What do you think? I mean, specifically for, I think you noted enrollment is one of those, for Dr. Jeremiah Shin, but for higher education overall as well.
Certainly, you know, we have lots of headwinds, both here in the state and nationally. It starts with we're seeing a fewer number of K-12 students. So just like as a business, you know, our customer base is going to be shrinking here in the years ahead, which is going to make things more competitive as we fend off, you know, universities from outside of Montana who come and try to recruit Montana students to an education that will be no better but much more costly. And so being able to ensure that we're providing a good product to keep Montana students home will be front and center. We also have a lot of work to do here at UM to make sure that our academic portfolio is in line with student and the state demands. You know, we have some work to do still, and we've made some great progress in the last couple of years to sunset some programs and put some programs into moratorium where we've seen student decline. But in order to do that, we need to be able to procure those resources from those changes to be able to invest in areas of great demand. You know, for example, UM, we launched 2 years ago a cybersecurity degree program. Yeah. We already have 70 students in that program by year two with very little marketing done. So, you know, we know where we're seeing student demand change, but that's also going to require us to make some tough decisions on some programs to likely sunset in the years ahead. And then lastly, you know, we've been talking a lot about the academics, but really in terms of the enterprise of the university, we're seeing lots of changes in college athletics, in student services, and things where outside of that, the hours that students are spending in the classroom, what do we need to do to make sure that the University of Montana can remain competitive? Again, whether that's in the athletic field, whether it's with student recruitment and internships and other opportunities. And so we think that Dr. Shin, given that experience he has at Boise, really understands that full set of challenges and comes with some pretty sharp tools to be able to bring some solutions to the table.
What's the deadline then? When does this transition take place? And when does Dr. Shin, you know, start, you know, well, again, we might be jumping a little bit, but probably not, theoretically. When does this all start?
you know, we got to plow through to commencement, which is about a month from now. And so we'll do that with the existing leadership team. And then hopefully shortly after that, so about mid-May, is when that transition will start to take place. And then, you know, we start a new fiscal year on July 1, and that seems to be a really good starting point where he can start fresh with a brand new budget year and have his team in place. And so right now it looks like everybody's aiming about midsummer really to hit the ground running and give him a little bit of time to make the transition up to Montana.
This is not the first rodeo for you either. Review this process. You know, talk about what stood out for you and basically that. Review the process for us.
Well, the University of Montana is a state agency, so it's a very public process. Mm-hmm. We worked through the Board of Regents. We had over 70 applicants. A working group was put into place to review all those applicants. That number got numbered down to about 9 folks who got interviews. We had a few finalists, and then Dr. Shin came to campus as really the lone campus visit, which showed how much he stood out as compared to some of those other finalists. But what really stood out for me, and you know this, Tom, is when folks choose the University of Montana, they almost become a shareholder of the university. And to see how many folks of the public, whether it's current students and employees, former students and employees, alums, Grizz fans, really participated in this process and provided feedback and really helped to drive Commissioner Christian and the working group with the factors that they wanted to see in a leader was really unique and special. And I think it helped make the process really smooth. You know, this is a special university, especially for those of us who chose it. And when you have a turnover in leadership, it really gives us a tremendous opportunity to put that flag in the ground and really stake what we're about and to be able to find a leader that shares those values of making sure that the university can continue to grow, can continue to compete and win was something that was really important to a lot of us. And I think we have the guy who's going to do just that.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I'm glad the process you feel was well run and you've come to a good conclusion on that as well. Do I get to torture him on the air here sometime, though?
Yes, we'll get him on soon, and get him on, especially during football season, so you can give him some live feedback of how the team's doing in those first few weeks. We'll make that a top priority.
Well, we many of us remember Boise State as a member of the Big Sky Conference, and so I still have a rough time even saying the word Bronco. But
that's right. Yeah, you'll have to remind me of that when we get into the studio there.
That's good. Dave said so. Hey, Dave, thanks for that. I appreciate the work you do, too. You know, we get to communicate back and forth about some things you're doing. We're always big education fans. So thanks for coming on today, and congratulations on the search.
Yep, thanks, Tom, and thanks for all the work that you and the team do and bringing the news every day. And we're loyal listeners over here. So to you and the listeners, whenever anyone wants to hear anything from UM, don't be shy to ask, as we're ready to hop on at a moment's notice.
Sweet. And let me say it. Go Grizz. Okay.
That's right. Go Grizz.
Let me say it again. Go Grizz.
All right. Yep, say it loud for all the folks in the studio.
Go Grizz! Dave Coots, thanks. You go as well, Dave. See you later, okay?
Thanks, Tom. Okay.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.